Welcome to the Productivity Mastery Podcast, presented to you by myself, Stoyan Yankov, productivity and performance coach, keynote and TEDx speaker, and co-author of the Perform Methodology, and the book Perform, the Unsexy Truth About Startup Success. Join me on a journey to discover what some of the world's leading professionals do to be more productive, create peak performing teams, and build successful global companies. New episodes weekly. And now, enjoy today's episode. Welcome back to Productivity Mastery. Another week, another exciting guest here with me. And we actually have quite an interesting story the way we met. Akush, would you mind sharing the story?
Yeah, I was invited to the Brand Festival in Budapest, which is a pretty nice event. It was held actually in a cinema, and I was preparing for my usual participation in a panel discussion. And then with the fellow panelists, we had just a casual discussion, you know, preparing, discussing the topics. We were sitting around this cocktail table, drinking our coffee to get the speed up. And then this random guy comes, starts to chat. That's you, by the way. and then we ask, okay, what's your background? What do you do? And then just randomly, I think I was the guy who just dropped in the idea that, okay, well, why didn't you join the panel discussion? Actually, we had a dropout, so there was a guy who didn't come. And I said, okay, why don't we have an international panel? Why don't we have you on the panel? I would love it. And then, yeah, obviously you said, yeah, why not? Let's do it. And I think it was a pretty good panel.
I think I said, yeah, let's do it. And then I ask you, what is the panel about? but yeah, in truth, I was getting my morning cafe latte at the coffee machine because I did my keynote the day before. So exactly. You know, when you do that, the second day it's like, okay, let me just go around, meet people.
Yeah, do networking.
Having a coffee, and your fellow panelist was like, are you here for the panel? You're going to be part of the panel? I'm like,
I don't know.
Sure, man, I can do that, you know. What is the panel? And he's like, I know we have a guy who's not coming, but maybe I thought it's you. Like, it's not me, but it can be me. So
yeah, you have this pro tip to be the most valuable person in the room or at the event, and you just kind of exercise it or practice it by getting into random panels wherever you are.
It's great. I mean, it was great. We had a great time. And you switched the language to English, so I'm grateful.
Yeah, I love that. We should have more international panels in all the events.
Shout out to Brand Festival for connecting us. Great event. So, okay, let's get to the point. So today we'll talk about entrepreneurship. Today we'll talk about productivity. How do you build a team? But maybe let's start with a little bit about prior to the podcast, we were discussing the importance of time management. And you gave me a bit of a context about how occupied you are. So maybe give us a bit of an idea. What are you up to these days, and how much time do you have on your calendar?
Okay. So I have my coffee mug, and on the bottom of that coffee mug, everybody has a nickname, and mine is Mr. Overlap. Because in my calendar, I typically have overlapping meetings, and I started to have this nickname in the company, but I don't think it's a very good nickname, so we should be very structured and organized, that typically I start to have overlapping meetings, and then I have to do a very wise time management. Back to the point, I run a company called Talkabot. We also have a product called Check. We operate in 4 countries with a direct team. This company is now up for more than 7 years in the making, with about a team of 50 people internationally. Besides that, I sit on the board of the Association of IT Companies in Hungary and on the supervisory board of Startup Hungary Foundation, which are kind of like CSR activities. I'm also practicing martial arts for 24 years, so that's something I want to do multiple times a week. And last but most importantly, probably, I am a husband and the father of three small kids, 2, 4, and 6-year-old kids. So that's a pretty packed schedule, I would assume, with some traveling as well, obviously, for the 4 countries.
So let's maybe start with the personal productivity. I mean, today we'll talk about Teams primarily, but I wanna hear maybe what do you do to stay on top of things? What is your system to manage and prioritize?
Yeah, so I think first I will answer it. How does it look today with such a team and with a team of 50 people? Because it's very, very different than what it used to be when we were at the super early stage of the company. Nowadays, what I try to do is that pretty frequently I look back into my calendar and start to see what meetings were high added value, mid added value, or low added value. For example, if I'm managing, I don't know, the supply to the coffee machine, it's probably not the best use of my time because it's a lower added value. If I'm doing a podcast and it has a multiplier effect, I consider that definitely as a high added value. Also, I have to devote certain time for one-on-ones, you know, treating well my team and spending time with them. But I try to be mindful of the amount of time I use for high added value, maybe mid added value, but very personal, people-oriented tasks. And I try to get away as much as possible from the low added value tasks. But you know, it's still a scale-up company. It's still a small company.
How many people you said?
50.
50 people. Okay. And when is it that you have like kind of a process? Like some people do it on Friday, on Sunday, like kind
yeah,
of.
Yeah, exactly. I typically do it on Fridays.
That's on Friday. Okay. What do you? How does it look like? Like your little planning, strategizing session.
I open my calendar and I try to use some color codings visually. I see these high, medium, or low added value tasks, and I try to see if the proportion is roughly okay. I also manage the company by an OKR system, objectives and key results. And actually, for a couple of quarters, I had the objective to spend 75% of my time focusing on the export activities, because that's our biggest challenge to replicate the success from our home country, Hungary, to the other three countries where we are moving into. So it's very easy, and that's one of the entrepreneurial mistakes we had, that if you start to become successful on your home market, then it becomes just harder and harder to break away from it, because you know growing the next 10% is always easier on your home country than moving into a very hostile or unknown environment. It's always a lot more effort. So consciously, I force myself to focus on the strategically important tasks and dedicate my time for those activities.
Great, man. Let's look back into the early days and maybe if you can reflect backwards, what helped you to get to the place where you are? Like now you're 50 people, and I'm sure you now have systems, structures, you know, OKRs, all these kind of things. But initially, if you were to give advice to these early stage founders listening to the podcast, what would be your advice for initially building a team that's producing results, that's productive?
Okay. So when we just started, we were a team of four guys. We started this company with, I think, the right setup. So that's, I think, point number one is that you have to have the right founding team with the roles properly assigned, with the characters properly mixed, together.
Did you know your co-founders from before starting the company?
Yeah, actually, I was the guy who just pulled together the team and assembled the characters and the professional backgrounds. But still, even with this, when we started and we started to have first few professional meetings, everybody was everywhere. And then we very quickly realized that we need to create our own job descriptions and we need to set up communication channels so our CTO doesn't have to sit in sales meetings. and vice versa. So we have to have proper roles and responsibilities in the company. And then we have to craft out certain job descriptions or groups to assign it to employees, to hire the first employees. I think a lot of the founders, the first hires are generalists, so kind of assistants or mini-me type of people that we expect to do everything on our behalf. Typically, these type of people burn out very fast. I would advise to pick roles that are very helpful. In my case, and for my specific character, it was a project manager. Somebody to keep track of time, to keep track of the tasks, because I have, as an entrepreneur, probably 20 different work streams. I have the operation of the company, I have sales, I have strategy, product development, etc. Everything probably. And, you know, keeping track of the follow-ups is a totally different personality, in my opinion, and requires certain project management skills. So in my case, it was a project manager type of a person. We defined projects for that person, and it was this person's job to make me accountable to meet the deadlines that are supposed to be met.
There's different ways to identify who is the kind of person that we can bring on board that will generate enough value for us to pay them salary. And it's kind of the reflection is starting with, you know, where is my time going? Like, what are some of the things that I, you know, as you said, these low impact tasks or things that I'm doing right now, they're eating my time, so I can focus my time on the high priority, high impact tasks like bringing in customers, product, strategy, those kind of things, right? I wonder if you can share any kind of a recommendation or suggestion or maybe like a tool, I don't know, to how do you identify whom to hire initially?
Well, I think not just initially, but as you grow, it's in a lot of cases, it's a self-reflection. So what is the task that I'm doing and I'm not the best to do it? And it can be a lot of things. If this role starts to become big enough to assign a role for it, then you have to hire a person. I think in many cases it's tough because you need, let's say, half a person at the beginning. You don't have money to pay a full person. And then if you hire half a person, but that person is not really attentive, is not very focused, do you get the value out of it? So it can be very, very challenging in many cases. But as a thumb rule, I try to have a self-reflection. I did everything probably in the company, almost everything, each and every role. And that's why as a founder, as an entrepreneur, you are probably a valuable asset to the company because you can do a public speaking, you can go into the product, you can speak with customers, you can do legal stuff, but you're not the best in those. So be mindful of that and hire a better person for that specific aspect. Another key consideration is the question whether you need to hire a junior person or a more senior. Hiring juniors, we made a mistake once after our first investment round. We hired like 10, 12 juniors within a quarter, and it practically ate up the time of the whole founding team to do the onboarding and babysit them. It just wasn't productive at all, and we wasted a lot of money and time due to that. Another group that works very well for me are corporate guys that burned out of the corporate job and are eager to do something meaningful. It may not be the best description of the topic, and I hope that nobody finds it any disrespectful, but there are great professionals who just hate working for a multinational company, for a corporate job. I see many people in high up positions that become a baker or that go out into agriculture to, you know, get their hands dirty and do something meaningful. I think a startup is a great place that wherever you are, you cannot hide in the company, and you do something meaningful that has a very direct impact. And if you can find the right corporate guy who is eager to do something meaningful that has a direct effect, I think you catch gold. You may not have to overpay him because they are in that section of their career, but they can do great things. So I would recommend this type of character.
I love it, man. It's looking for the arbitrage opportunity, right? Like you get the skill, the experience, perhaps the passion as well, because they want now to go and do something meaningful. And again, in the normal circumstances, probably wouldn't be able to afford, you know, on a startup salary, people, especially initially, with this kind of seniority. But if you're more kind of mindful and you look for the opportunities out there, you can bring somebody on board. And I love that you said maybe you cannot get people on board full time. Have you had a chance to get people who are more senior, but you couldn't afford them? So maybe you got them for part time or.
So I have a structure for that, and it works pretty well for me. Especially if I don't want to pay them the full market price, or I can't. Let's just put it that way. I can't pay them the full market price. We try to agree on, let's say, 3 times a week or 4 times a week, if possible. And I openly tell the person that that he or she can take side jobs, side hustles. But I want the main attention to be on me, but it's okay to do other projects. And I find that especially with this type of character, it works great because they don't burn out. They get different viewpoints. They get exposed to different companies, different products. They see the challenges on the market from a different viewpoint as well. But they're full, or not the full, the main attention is still on me. If we agree in another terminology that, yeah, I want 25% of your time or 50% of your time, it's just a different mindset, how we do it. And I had cases when the person on the fifth day was out on the vineyard or doing a training to become a better animator, and actually trained him or herself to become better at the job. So it's also a setup, because these people in this life situation, they value their free time as well. So the fact that they don't have to work, I don't know, 40 or 60 hours a week like others is very valuable. They are willing to go lower on the cost.
And the setup is it per hour? Is it like, you know, you work 50%, but you decide to win? Like, what are different setups that could work in such a case?
Well, you practically establish kind of the market value of the job, of the position, and then I pay like 80 or 60% of it, depending on the 3 or 4 days per week setup. So it's a fair value proportionate to a full-time job, but I still pay less. And from my perspective, so far when I did this, most of the cases I felt that I actually got the full value, because I got the full professional skill set of the person. Maybe not the full capacity, but the know-how, the experience actually came in fully.
I had a conversation with the founder of Thunderbeam. It's an Estonian company, actually similar size. It was around 50 people the time we had a podcast. Kaidi Ruselep, if you're listening, shout out to Kaidi. And when I asked her about the seniority of the people they're bringing on board, she said, I think we only have one junior person in the whole company. And I'm like, okay, why is that? You know, you have 50 people. She said, well, first of all, the kind of things that we do are very specific, technical, but secondly, we don't have time to, I mean, you mentioned the term babysit. I don't know if that's the best term, but like, we don't have time to spend a lot of energy on growing and teaching and giving feedback and pushing people, because we're just super busy. So we would rather get less senior people. But I think it's an interesting topic because, again, when you're small, you cannot afford it. A lot of people would go for, let me build somebody from school and spend maybe 6 months and kind of build them into a very specific role. I wonder what if you can kind of expand on that and maybe tell me now that you're 50, how many people are more junior in terms of experience?
I want to be fair with the younger generation. I think babysitting may not be the best term, to be honest. You're right about it. We have very, very good experience with the juniors as well. We have people, we even have now people who are like 5 years with us or 6 years with us. And we had many cases, people staying with us for 3-4 years. Generally, what I hear on the market is that Gen Z, they say they don't want to work. There's very high churn. There's very high turnover with these people. Honestly speaking, I don't experience this. I think we're looking for a very specific character who are self-motivated, who want to grow, who want to have a meaningful job. We are looking for these type of people, and they grow amazingly fast. Really, it's amazing. And what we have to be careful as managers, not to hold them back, but to amplify their drive, their energy. They are bringing in so good ideas regarding the use of AI or of different online tools that can boost our productivity. It's amazing. We just hired a young fellow. Shout out to Jan Molski, for example, in Poland, and we saw his like this genius type of. Personality, and we showed him our sales deck. We told him that, you know, it's under renovation. We hired an agency to rebrand it, refresh the look and feel of the slides. And then a day later, he comes in and like generated a totally new version of the sales deck, not only with AI, but also with his own thoughts. And actually, to be honest, it was in many ways better than what we were working on for 2 months with the professional agents. So I think there are a lot of good examples. I love to work with the younger generation. I try to treat them as respectful as everybody else. And they, as I feel, appreciate it. And they really do their best to be valuable.
And, you know, maybe I want to also expand on that. Like, if you are in this age group and you're listening right now, if you're a young aspiring leader now, it's not about your age. It's about what can you bring to the table. I mean, it could be 20 years old, but if you want to be ahead of the game and to be valuable at the marketplace, you have to switch the script a little bit and try to put yourself in the shoes of the, in this case, the startup founder who is about to hire you. Okay, you have this amazing degree from this university. Who cares? What can you do for me? What can you deliver as results? So if you're in school, don't spend all your time studying and doing exams. Volunteer and gain experience. Get a job. Be very specific in specific area. I don't know. Become a great growth marketer. Just do it, do it, do it. So now when you're 22, you actually have something to show. And from day one, with a little bit of adjustment, you can actually start delivering value. Like, nobody's paying you for your hours. People pay you for the value you create and generate. So try to think about that if you're in this kind of a, not only there, but generally if you're a young leader, something to think about.
But I think back to our setup, about maybe a third of our colleagues are in this junior stage in their career. And partially they want to come to work with us and they stay with us because we have very good seniors. So they feel that they can learn from them. And the seniors also love that they can work with the younger generation. So it becomes a synergy. We want to have senior people who can work and want to work with younger generations and want to constantly grow. One of our company values or cultural values is level up. We have this saying that what was enough last year will not be enough this year. And we say that every year. So every year we try to reinvent ourselves. When you are building a startup scale-up company, you don't want this organic growth and grow by 10%. You want to always find a way to hack the growth and become way more productive, way more valuable. So every year you have to ask yourself, okay, how do I do things pretty differently than last year? And for a senior to work with youngsters, younger generation, it is a great way to find new habits.
Oh, for sure, man, for sure. I wonder, how did you manage to attract the first few seniors that were, you know, top level professionals? Like, what would be your tips in terms of talent attraction on a budget?
I think I'm not as good as you in networking, but I'm not that bad in networking. And since I'm active in all these associations and foundations, I have a pretty wide network. So what I think I do very well is that I'm very honest and vocal about the problems that I face and the challenges that I have. So if I meet somebody and ask, how do you do? I don't just ask back, how do you do? But I start to engage in a meaningful conversation. You know, this is my challenge. I'm doing this. I'm looking for a professional in that area. And this evokes empathy. This evokes care in the other person that I'm speaking with. And then they say that, no, I know this guy, and he may be the perfect one. He seems to be, I don't know, burned out in his job, or they are switching position, or there's a big layoff. I love big layoffs in companies because that creates opportunity. They are not laying off people because they don't do their jobs very well, but I don't know, for some, I don't know, global corporate restructuring or whatever. So you can find real talents, maybe even in a good price or a very good value. I think that's a good way. So you have to be open-minded. You have to be vocal about who you're looking for and just spread it out in the network. Maybe not on Facebook or LinkedIn, post it, but especially in the early days, I think all the employees were based on recommendation. I actually got a really good hire. It was a lady who was a hostess on a stag party. So we were on a stag party on a boat in Budapest, and then she took us to, I don't know, shoot with a tank and, you know, this wild stag party set up, and she was our hostess. And I started to have a conversation with her, and she said that, yeah, I'm studying politics and international communication, and this is just a summer job for me, escorting drunk guys in stag parties. And I had a business card. I passed her a business card. And, okay, look at the company. Look at my LinkedIn profile. If you're interested, shoot me a CV. Bang. She was a great asset to the company.
But that's the thing, man. She was probably kind and nice. You can see the person. You're like, okay, this person, there's something about this person that will fit our culture.
Exactly.
And maybe that's another topic that we can kind of dive into. When was it the first time you and your co-founder started talking about your culture, your values, and you started intentionally building this culture?
Well, since the founding team consisted of more experienced people, probably I was the youngest and least experienced, but I already had about 10 years of experience working for HP Hewlett Packard. So we had international experience. Previously, I went through coaching. Actually, my sister is a psychologist, so I'm affected by this notion of organizational development and organizational psychology. So we did intentional team buildings, coaching sessions for the leaders, and I was mindful of that. But I think pretty early on, we defined one core value of our internal culture, and that is no bullshit. So that's what we said, and we even put it in our CVs. And it was interesting to see that many applicants reflect on it, especially the more experienced guys that, yeah, I'm looking for a no bullshit culture. And they were asking me back, how do you define no bullshit culture? And why is your culture no bullshit? And if they liked the answer, it created an attraction for them towards the company. So I think this was important. And then later on, we also defined, I think 2 years ago, three more values. One I already mentioned, it was the level up, that every year we try to reinvent ourselves and become more productive. The other is hard deadlines, that we have like normal deadlines, like, okay, we go for lunch at noon. That's not a hard deadline. But for customer deadlines, for other specific important deadlines, we say that, okay, these deadlines should have, you know, some serious consequence if it's not met. It has a direct effect on us. For example, if you're not meeting an investor milestone and you don't get the next tranche of your investment, probably you don't have money to pay salaries. So it's kind of a hard deadline. And reflecting back to the no bullshit culture, if we can properly communicate that to our team, that guys, we need to close deals, we need to ship projects, we need to keep customers happy. Otherwise, yeah, we cannot grow. We cannot keep our team. It's very important. So this hard deadline, and then actually 2 years ago, it may be interesting, but we had the fourth is unify. Because as the team starts to grow, if I start to have a middle management, these teams start to bond together. So even though it's still a small company, maybe 30, 40 people, it's a small company, you start to have silos, which was fascinating for me to see that the teams start to bond around their direct manager. And then if a manager maybe has a conflict, not a personal conflict, but maybe a professional conflict, like, you know, fighting for scarce resources, which happens a lot in companies, then the different teammates start to have maybe even a personal quarrel in between each other due to these professional boundaries. So we started to pay attention on mixing the teams, on not allowing small team buildings, but only full company team building. Other small things that help to, you know, change perspectives, empathize better with colleagues in other fields. Another natural cat and mouse quarrel is between product or developers and sales. These bloody sales guys, they do networking, they are in the high life. Life is easy for them. Why don't they bring in more deals? Okay, and the developers. I'm actually an IT engineer. So for the developers, show me when you code all those bugs. When did you code those bugs? I don't pay you for coding bugs. Why don't you meet your deadline? Why doesn't it work? Why don't we ship developments faster, etc.? So it's a very natural thing to. The quarrels between these teams. So as a manager, how do I keep the competition, which is, I think, a very fruitful and productive way of stress, but how do I keep it on the nice and friendly level?
Do you have any resources you can recommend on the topic of like maybe some books that were impactful to you, or podcasts, or like where is the inspiration coming from?
Well I can specifically mention Techstars. We are lucky to be a Techstars backed company. We went through the accelerator that was supported by Rakuten, and it took place in Singapore, and during that time, I read all the Techstars books. So if you go into the techstars.com, I think they have awesome content for founders and entrepreneurs, not only startupers, but in general. And mentorship was very important part of the Techstars accelerator. We had something like 60 different mentors some lead mentors, also the managers of the program. So maybe I would name Driti Manhui, who was the program manager, and Dennis List, who was the other manager of the program. Plus, we participated in the university. By the way, we started the whole company after an MBA program. And the university had an accelerator. And Andrea Cosma, the leader of this accelerator, is still on our supervisory board, still a very close mentor to us. So finding a few key mentors is key. I think reading books is great to have tips, but along the entrepreneurial journey, you will become lonely, you will have a lot of problems, you will face a lot of stress, and you have to be able to share it with somebody, and mentors come in for that role.
I want to dive deeper into one of the values that you mentioned, hard deadlines. And more, it sounds great, but how do you make it work in practice? Like specifically, are the people who are supposed to deliver on the deadlines setting their own deadlines? Like, do you have any weekly meetings where like, or like a board where people, like, how do you make it work in practice? Because that's something that many founders are struggling with, right? How do we get, even if we as founders are very accountable, how do we make our team accountable and hard on deadlines?
Okay, while I think about the answer, let me have a moment of bio break just to blow my nose. I just mute myself and jump out. Sorry, I guess
no bit bullshit. Of I love it. No bullshit.
Okay. Kids, you know, small kids, kindergarten, all the diseases that they bring home. So back to the question, the hard deadline. Yeah, we actually have a sub name for it, a nickname. It's Hades. I think that's the Greek god of hell. Mm. It's hard deadline society. So we start to give these names. I think. If it's catchy, if it's okay, hard deadline, it's not so catchy, but if Hades and you associate it with burning hell and make it very visual, it becomes helpful as well. So hard deadline society is the way to go. And you can't have a lot of hard deadlines at a certain point in time of the company. So you have to have you know, like a public announcement that, okay, this is a hard deadline for us. You have to allocate the proper resources, and the people who participate in the project directly have to accept the deadline. And we made some rules around it that you cannot, if it's a hard deadline, you can never miss it and announce it afterwards. So in many cases, a release, you're on the release day and say, and the developers will say that, oh, we will do the release next week. We're almost done. We just have to do some finishing touches. So this is totally unacceptable. I would even fire somebody for that if it's a hard deadline. If it's a hard deadline, you can always say that we have a risk of a slippage that we foresee unless we get, I don't know, additional resources or whatnot. Then the management can decide whether we can allocate those additional resources or not. But if it was not pre-announced and pre-agreed, the deadline has to be met. If they need to stay in the office or in front of the computer at night, who cares? Probably they took a little bit of relaxing time at the beginning of the project, or it's not the same workload, but the deadline has to be met. We're also vocal about the consequences. So why is it a hard deadline? We get a penalty by the customer. People are not getting a bonus payment, for example, just to have, you know, something positive. If you meet the deadline, then we meet an important business milestone and we are able to pay bonuses. If you don't meet the deadlines, you don't get the bonus in best chance. So build up this structure around, okay, why is it important? People have to accept it. what are the resources? People have to accept the deadline and set the rules that, okay, you can always ask for help. You can always pre-announce that, okay, you face unexpected challenges, but it's never okay to announce last minute that, oh, sorry, we will not meet the deadline. It's just not okay. So we have a couple of these deadlines, these hard deadlines in the company, and they seem to work well. And people in our company start to use these terminologies, and I think it's very, very important.
And operationally, how do you run? Is every team managing in the way they feel, or do you have any kind of a, when you mentioned OKRs, for example, any more specific, I don't know, rules and guidelines? Every week you need to have a weekly, and how do you
run? So with OKRs, we currently have three levels of OKRs. We have six objectives, which we call level one objectives, which are the main company level objectives. And under that, the middle management has its own level two OKRs. So I have the two business units, the Talkabot product, the Czech product. I have the CTO, I have the sales and marketing manager, and they all create their level two OKRs that obviously fit into the level one OKRs. And then the level three OKRs are the personal level OKRs. So we try to define personal level key results and objectives for everybody. And then since it's managed in a software which is Jira based, so all our developers and salespeople can use it, it kind of automatically feeds into the level one OKR. So if as the level three objectives and key results are met, it automatically feeds into the top level. So on the weekly management meeting, we just do a synchronization. We go until level two, see if there's a progress, if there's any hurdle that we have to keep an eye on, then we look into that. Honestly speaking, it's not easy to set it up. We're not doing it perfectly. It's a lot of time to set the right level one OKRs and to distribute it to the whole team. So this is March and we don't have all the level three OKRs set up yet, which is not ideal. We have to be better on that. But I think the most important ones are already set up and monitored on a weekly basis. So that's good. And regarding the hard deadlines, those are topics that we monitor every week. So it's not that, so we ask about them every week. Okay, is it going well? Is it on track? Are there any risks? If there's no risk highlighted, then we shouldn't have a problem at the end. We did it very selectively last year, the hard deadlines. So we had like three hard deadlines for the whole company. This year, the level up is that the teams are also allowed to set up their own hard deadlines. So previously, it was a very exclusive thing to management, and then we spread across the message for everybody. This year, the level up compared to last year's hard deadlines is that people can define their own hard deadlines, or a smaller team hard deadline, or a unit hard deadline can be set up. So we want to extend it because we have to be even better in keeping our deadlines and timelines. But you know, to define for every hard deadline these things I mentioned before, so why is it a hard deadline, what are the consequences, how do you allocate resources, these should be there still, otherwise it doesn't work.
Okay, now let's I have a question I wanted to ask you, connected to, and again, we're maybe going backwards in time, but it's if you go back, if you can go back to the initial days of your startup journey, who would be the kind of people, like the roles that you wish you hired earlier?
It's a very hard question, because if you would have asked who I wouldn't have hired, that's much easier. And I will just very quickly answer my own question. Okay. It's because I had a couple of hires that were, that we were premature. The product was premature. So I think the person was good. The person was able to deliver what we wanted him or her to do, but not within our own context, not with our own product. And that's a very, very painful and expensive learning. That if you hire an experienced person who cannot deliver, it's bad. It's bad in terms of cost, in terms of, you know, breakup and all that. And to admit that the person was not delivering, not because the person, but because of us, because we are not good enough. It's a very hard learning. So even hiring the most experienced person, let's say you want to have the best CFO. A good CFO doesn't touch an Excel sheet, doesn't touch any numbers. The good CFO has a team for accounts payable, accounts receivable, payroll, operations, and he's looking at the cap table or the balance sheet of the company and plans the balance sheet, plans the next investment role. In a startup CFO, you have somebody who's really deep into numbers and at one minute actually writes the invoice, next minute calls up a customer for a late payment because there's, I don't know, 5 days delay in payment and we cannot pay our own bills. So I think the life cycle of the company really defines the type of people you can work with. And simply you cannot work with high level, super experienced people because they just cannot show their value.
Let me ask it a little bit differently. What are some roles that often get overlooked when it comes to, you know, maybe initially, early in the journey, you start hiring? What would be some positions and roles that maybe startups, from your experience, a little bit too late to get people on board?
What I did, I think, pretty well is that I think a second or third hire was a graphics designer, full-time graphics designer, who became an art director or some fancy name later on in London for a brand. He was really a very, very talented guy. And to create a very good, catchy visual brand and beautiful slides and a cohesive brand for all the proposals, documents, user manuals, everything. It's so important because even if your product is in a pilot phase, you can make it look much more professional just by visuals. And graphics designer is typically not the most expensive resource in the company. You can there's a big supply of graphics designers and talented people in that area, and it can early on make your company look way more professional than it is in reality. So that would be pro tip number one. Pro tip number two is that early on I hired not full time, but this 60 to 80% a PR person, public relations person, which is again not obvious at all, but the person had readily available great contacts in the media, and I think the first time I paid for a PR article was six or seven years after I established the company. So we had very, very good, very frequent PR, high up PR, just because this guy had good contacts and he was a very good storyteller and created stories and articles that were considered not as a paid promotion, paid PR, but an earned media, earned PR. So I think looking at his cost, if I would calculate it in the normal cost of issuing all these PR articles, it was probably a very good investment. It also helps you to tell your pitch much better. So as a founder, as an entrepreneur, you are very deep into the product, and expressing yourself to anybody in plain words is not an easy thing in many cases, especially when you're looking for product market fit and you're also not entirely sure yourself what the product is. Having somebody who can, whose best ability is in words, in expressing himself, can be very valuable. So I think these two hires are less obvious, but super valuable.
Oh, that's great, man. That's great you mentioned that. I don't think this is the first people that founders early on are having in mind for a full-time position. I mean, maybe you get the services kind of on a freelance basis because we need to set up this or that, but that's great, man. That's great. Great learnings. I wonder when for you was the time to look into somebody in the people department? What would be your recommendation? Somebody like, call it an HR role or people management?
Okay. So as I mentioned, even in the first year, we hired the coach to focus on the management team, not the full organization, but the management team. And then I think in year...
Just a second here. So you hired a coach, but what was the purpose? What was the setup? What did you want the coach to achieve?
So I think root cause number one for companies to die in the first or second year after establishment is founder conflict. That is the number one cause of death for companies and not even startups. Many smaller companies, founder conflict is a very usual thing. If there's not enough money because of that, if there's too much money because of that, but in any case, you will have conflict, a lot of conflict. So being mindful about it and preparing for these conflicts early on and binding the founding team is vital, is life and death in many cases. So I think the employees, yes, they are important, but if there's conflict within the founding team, it's a killer. It's very tough. And we had later on conflict, so we had to resolve it. But I think the fact that we got into where we are was partly thanks to the fact that we tried to resolve these conflicts, and early on we focused on bonding to each other. So I think that was very important. And later on, when we had a team of like 30 people, we hired a very good pair of consultants to do organizational development, to actually create an organizational structure like this, you know, tree structure or a matrix organization, something like that, to redefine roles and responsibilities, to show us some tips and tricks. But even their approach was not to come in as an HR person, but to give the management the abilities to manage the people better. And to be an extended arm. So if I had a problem, you know, we had some funny situations when our office is very central in the heart of Budapest, and I come into the office in the morning and I see a drunken guy laying on the floor in the office. He had some party the night before, and he came to the office because it was convenient. And I'm like, okay, so what to do? And I had an HR person to call him. Okay, I kind of like this guy. I have no personal issues with this topic. Maybe I would have done this myself, but you know, I'm general manager of this company. So how do you handle this as an employer? And how do you communicate that to the organization? just a funny thing, but it can be other more frequent stuff.
No, sure, man. Well, thank you for sharing on that. And since we are getting close to the end of the episode, I want to cover one more area. It's, you mentioned now that there's like 50 people. You're the CEO. You have a lot of more bigger picture responsibilities. I wonder, how is your time distributed in terms of doing more strategic, leading leadership kind of things, as opposed to operational, sort of like getting things done, and yeah. You know, what would be the proportion of your time? Like, is it from ensuring other people do their jobs to me doing the stuff and moving the needle.
So what I typically do during the day, during the working hours, is that I'm constantly on the call or on the phone or speaking with people in person, doing meetings with customers or partners or employees. My whole working hours are dedicated to this. Then I go home, have my family time, my daddy time, and then probably I have a second shift from 9 or 10 p.m. and I open my laptop and look at emails and try to process the emails. Typically during the day, even if I sit down to do some emails and respond to things, I get a lot of disruptions. So I try to put myself in different states of mind, like focus time, and I don't allow any notifications on my phone, and maybe spend an hour to do the emails. If I have to do it for any reason during the day, I still put my phone on Do Not Disturb, maybe put some music on that helps me to focus, and I try to dedicate that time to this. I think, I'm not sure what's your opinion, but in my opinion, disruption is the number one enemy, probably, or one of the top three enemies of productivity. Constantly get disrupted, your productivity drops.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why you got to plan effectively and find this space in which it's distraction free, so you can do your important work, your deep work. It could be different for any kind of founder, right? Like it could be, you know, some founders decide to wake up early. You know, like you have three kids, so it might be a little bit different. So, yeah. but it's like, again, you gotta personalize it to your own lifestyle. But you know, where is the time that I can have a space, a slot of, so I can get things done. I can be creative without any distractions.
For me, if it's a group work or people oriented, I do it during the day, and if it's a strategic initiative, maybe I dedicate a half day or full day or depending on the time frame that is needed. If it's something that I need to sit alone in front of a computer, I'm a late bird, so I just do it at home. I have a standing desk. I put on some music and I do it there. I can't do it during the day. It's just impossible for me. I have to do it in the evening. So when I did my financial plans, for example, for the investment and all this number crunching and planning, I spent late nights at home alone, and it was very productive in that case. So that's typically how I do it. I don't think there's a huge trick in that. The other I started to have for me, physical exercise and kung fu is a key for my brain abilities. So I'm lucky to have actually a kung fu mate of mine who comes to my office twice a week, and I just allocate my lunch break for practicing, and it's great because when you're doing kung fu, so it's a martial art, you really have to focus there. You cannot be on the phone or do five things in parallel; it's impossible. And it's kind of like a reset to my mind. After that, I'm super productive. So having even some time to break out, but focus your mind really helps you to be productive afterwards.
Have you asked this Kung Fu master to do something with the team as well? Like some kind of a...
No,
not yet.
No, but actually, the fact that I'm training here in the office twice a week, and they don't know that, okay, there's my Kung Fu mate coming in, it actually evoked that some people go out during the day for a gym or start the day with a swim, and they are also very vocal and open about it. I think everybody does it at every workplace, but they feel that it's kind of a cheat time, or they break out from the job. I don't think that's a good company culture. I expect each and every colleague of mine to do some sports to try to stay fit, healthy. And if they want to go out during the day, obviously, if it's not a meeting that is time sensitive, then I even encourage that.
All right, man. Thanks so much for all this. Thanks for being with us today. Final question. where could people get in touch? And maybe just give us a bit of an overview about what you guys actually do. Who can you help out there?
Okay, so if my name is there, I have a pretty specific name, so I would recommend LinkedIn to get in touch with me. It would be pretty easy. As I mentioned, the company name is Talkabot. That is the market-leading chatbot provider in Hungary. We work with the National Bank, Erste Bank, companies like Auchan and Nestle. So very wide, Burger King, a very wide scope of customers. It's an AI-based chatbot, mainly for customer service. And then about 4 years ago, we started a different product line called CHECK, C-A-G-Q. CHECK, as we call it, it's a workforce digital alignment tool. It's a new terminology. But the point of it is that we're focusing on companies with a lot of blue-collar workers, typically in these manufacturing, logistics, and retail companies. 70-80% of the people are not sitting in front of a computer. They don't have a company phone. They don't have a company email address. So reaching them, just shift it to places like WhatsApp or Viber groups or Facebook chats, something like that. And it creates a lot of noise and distraction, which is not good for productivity. So we try to create something like the Slack for factories, we can call it, which is an AI-assisted chatbot that communicates between employees and the company. But it's a private channel. It's not a group chat. We automate a lot of processes. We make communication efficient. It reduces fluctuation in the company. So it has a tons of good effects. And we are defining and building up this market at the moment in Hungary, Poland, Romania, and Bulgaria. We have over 100 customers, and again, big names like Bosch and Nestle and Autoliv or Electrolux, really a lot of companies and hundreds of, probably over 100,000 employees that use CHECK on a daily basis.
Great stuff, man. Thanks for being with us. And thanks, everybody, for listening to this episode of Productivity Master, episode 177, meaning there's 176 more episodes with amazing people like Akush that you can learn from. Experiential-based, obviously, based on experience, based on their own journey. Thank you for being with us. And see you once again next week for another episode of Productivity Mastery. Be cool.
Thank you guys for listening. Make sure to subscribe to my monthly newsletter by visiting stoyanyankov.com and also learn about the Perform methodology and the Perform book, as well as our various personal and team coaching offers. Stay tuned and keep performing.